Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. It seems these days like our civil rights, the Constitution, the environment, equality, voting rights, and just about everything we hold dear or take for granted are under assault as we're compelled to try to defend something, anything, but it's hard to know where to start or where to plug in. For some, it's reproductive rights, which may soon disappear completely in many states if Republicans get their way. For others, it's voting rights. Progress Ohio and other groups have been fighting hard on the redistricting front, yet proposals are still making their way through Republican gerrymandered state legislatures aimed at disenfranchising voters, especially non-white voters, and the economically deprived. Housing costs are rising thanks to unregulated real estate speculation, displacing people from their own neighborhoods and pricing them out of others. The recent deadly mudslides and flooding in Brazil are the direct result of climate change and deforestation, and the horrific unprecedented wildfire in New Mexico is the result of an unprecedented drought. Add to this the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a massive crime against humanity unfolding day by day, which the United States seems intent on prolonging and escalating by favoring military solutions over diplomatic opportunities. We've covered all of these here on Conscious Voices, but it's been a while since we've discussed another illegal invasion, that of Palestine, by imperialist Israel. And as if under the cover of all of those other crises, Israel has recently ramped up its assault, bulldozing hundreds of Palestinian homes to make room for a military training camp, and targeting a large area in the occupied West Bank for the construction of 4,300 new illegal settlements. Naturally, there have been protests from Palestinians and even occasional acts of violence, but nothing compared to the daily onslaught of vandalism, physical attacks, and other provocations by the Israeli settler class, which regularly destroys olive trees, breaks windows, injures Palestinian citizens, including children, and just this past week staged an Israeli nationalist march, Charlottesville-style, through a Palestinian neighborhood. Israeli snipers shot and killed an American journalist several weeks ago, and you would think that, at some point, the response from the U.S. State Department would be greater than just a toothless rhetorical condemnation. But U.S. policy toward Israel has been essentially linear from one administration to the next, with the exception of the Trump regime, which more actively encouraged the Israeli right wing. In today's show, we'll hear three reports, one from Al Jazeera News, about the killing of the American journalist, Shireen Abu Al-Kay, and we'll hear a report about the Americans working in Israel to drive Palestinians from their homes, and we'll have a brief report about that Israeli nationalist march. We'll start with the murder of Shireen Abu Al-Kay.
ICE is talking right now about the killing of our colleague. Let's listen.
As being essential to inclusive and tolerant societies, it is heart-wrenching to see the killing of another journalist just 1 week later. We call for an immediate and thorough investigation and full accountability. Investigating attacks on independent media and prosecuting those responsible are of paramount importance. We will continue to promote media freedom and protect journalists' ability to do their jobs without fear of violence, threats to their lives or safety, or unjust detention. Her death is a tragic loss and an affront to media freedom everywhere. With that, I'll take your questions.
Thanks.
Matt, I see you have a minder with you today.
Yeah,
I'm very glad to see it.
Yes. My boss, this is Anna. Ned.
No.
Good to meet you. We'll talk later today.
Yes. On this situation, when you call for an immediate and thorough investigation, who exactly do you want to do that?
It is important to us that those who are responsible for her death be held responsible, that full accountability be ensured in this case.
Okay, but my question is not that. My question is, who do you think could conduct a credible investigation into her death that would be accepted by all parties, including the United States?
Well, in this case, I'm not going to prejudge where any investigation may go. We've seen, of course, that the Israeli Defense Forces have already announced that there is an investigation underway. We welcome that announcement. It is important to us, it is important to the world, that investigation be thorough, that it be comprehensive, that it be transparent, and importantly, that investigations end with full accountability and those responsible for her death being held responsible for their actions.
Okay, but I mean, do you want the Palestinians to be involved in the investigation?
The IDF has announced an investigation.
Right, that's the IDF.
Correct.
I standing for Israel.
That is correct.
So what about the Palestinians? Because there are calls in Israel for the Palestinians to take part in this.
What is, and I'm sure the Palestinians will do their own review as well. We've heard statements from both Israelis and Palestinians over the course of the day. What is important to us is that those responsible for this killing be held accountable for their actions.
Okay. So, all right. So just one more thing, and then I'll defer. Are you confident that, maybe you're not because the investigation hasn't been done, but does it appear to you, circumstances right now, as you know, that she was targeted because she was a journalist?
I'm not going to prejudge an investigation. That's precisely why we're calling for an investigation. We've heard the statements that she was clearly, she was wearing a tire that was clearly marked her as a journalist, but we are going to wait for the investigation to go where it goes. We are going to wait to hear where the facts lead in this case, and importantly, to see the accountability that is mounted in the aftermath of that investigation. Site.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, do you trust Israel investigating itself? I mean, I have asked this question over the past 20 years so many times. Do you trust them? Have they ever come back to you with saying, these are the results? I mean, you know, only in January, Omar Asghar died in their custody. And you said, and he was a Palestinian American. And you said from that podium, you said that you are waiting on their investigating. You have not even followed through on this. So do you trust the Israelis investigating themselves?
The Israelis have the wherewithal and the capabilities to conduct a thorough, comprehensive investigation. Let me give you an example, because you asked the question. In June of 2020, Israeli police in Jerusalem's Old City fatally shot, and you are familiar with this case, Iliad Halak, a Palestinian resident with autism, after he allegedly failed to stop and to obey orders. About a year later, in June of 2021, the Ministry of Justice's Department for Investigations of Police Officers, DIPO, filed an indictment with the Jerusalem District Court against the border police officer who shot and killed Halak. Clearly, Israeli authorities have the wherewithal to conduct a thorough, comprehensive investigation. That is what we expect in this case. In this case, we expect that the perpetrators, those responsible for the death of Shireen, who, by the way, was a very close contact of our post, someone our people, someone presumably many of you knew quite well.
She was with us in this room.
It is important to us that her legacy be honored, be protected with accountability for those who senselessly took her life.
Well, you know, on this police case that you cited, just bear with me, indulge me, my colleague. You know, on this case that you cited, you know, the Israelis charged the policeman with something like maybe $10 fine and so on. I don't want to delve into that. But you talked about Press Freedom Day last week. Press Freedom Day. You never mentioned the Palestinian journalist. There are 15 Palestinian journalists in prison. In prison. They're held there, as we say in Arabic, Zura al-Mubahtani, which means falsely and malevolently. They have been held there day after day, year after year. They are disallowed from conducting their work, from doing their work, including colleagues of mine from my newspaper. So I want you to respond to that. I mean, you talked about other things, which is laudable, which is great. Talk about what journalists face in Ukraine and other places, but you never mentioned what Palestinian journalists face.
Saeed, we know what many Palestinian journalists have faced, and we've commented quite a bit on that. You well remember what we said in the aftermath of the strike last year against the Associated Press building, against the Al Jazeera building in Gaza. We had an opportunity to speak to that publicly. Secretary Blinken had an opportunity to speak to the editor-in-chief of the Associated Press in the aftermath of that strike. We have spoken vociferously about the rights to a free press around the world. The fact that reporters should not be targeted, reporters should not be the objects of violence or suppression or repression anywhere around the world, whether that country is an autocracy, a democracy, whether that country is a friend, or whether that country is a foe or competitor.
Let me just follow up on how journalists, Palestinian journalists, when there is an operation like this, the Israelis were about to storm the Jenin refugee camp. They go by, including the group that was with Shirin, including someone from my newspaper. They went by the Israelis that were standing right out there. And they said, we're going right there. They told them this morning, we're going to go right there. So they knew perfectly. They knew exactly who was there and how clearly marked these people were. So I want to hear from you. If ever the investigation shows the guilty party, should that guilty party be prosecuted to the full extent of the law?
Those responsible for Shireen's killing should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Ned, yes. Sorry, just really briefly, since you brought it up, the bombing of the AP and the Al Jazeera office in Gaza, did you guys ever get an explanation from the Israelis that was satisfactory?
We were in contact with the Israelis. They shared with us some of the information regarding that strike.
Did you think that it was a legit target?
Clearly, the fact that there were the offices of at least two independent media organizations made it highly concerning, highly troubling to us.
Is it still troubling, or were your concerns resolved?
It's
been almost literally that happened on May 15th of last year. It's now what, May 11th?
That assessment has not changed.
So you're still troubled by it. In other words, the explanation that the Israelis gave to you did not.
We voiced our concern by the fact that journalists were put at risk, that their offices came under assault.
It's been a year, so I just want to know if the Israeli explanation has satisfied you, and so those concerns are no, you don't have those.
Those concerns still exist. Yes.
Will you send someone to the church on Friday for the service of the Iran?
I will check with Post, as I know, as I relayed to you, she was a close contact of Post. They were in regular contact with her. They valued her work. They valued, in some cases, a personal friendship and relationship with her. And if we have anything to say regarding representation, we'll let you know. Francesca.
Has the secretary spoken to any leader in Israel or Palestinian side about this? And just to on the record, do you have any early assessment or understanding of who did that?
We're not going to prejudge an investigation. We've heard various statements throughout the day. Some of those statements have shifted. That's why we've called for a thorough, comprehensive investigation ending in accountability. There have been a number of conversations by senior officials in this building, senior officials at our embassy in Jerusalem, to both Israeli and Palestinian counterparts, conveying many of the same messages I conveyed to you just now. Yes.
Can I briefly ask about Hong Kong and Taiwan?
Sure.
I still have something on Shireen. If I can.
Let's take one more question on this, and then I'll come right back to you next.
I have one question too, please.
Okay. Go ahead.
Many press and human rights organizations are calling for international independent investigation into her killings, because they condemned Israeli behavior before, that they're not going to thoroughly investigate themselves. Are you willing to support such efforts to turn this into an international investigation?
Israel has the wherewithal and the capability to conduct a thorough, comprehensive investigation. They've done it before, and we expect they'll do so in this case. Yes.
Do you intend to conduct your own investigation, or at least participate, since our colleague, she's an American Palestinian, because the record shows that Israeli investigation on those kind of incident haven't been reliable. So I wonder if you are planning to do your part of the investigation.
Our role, every time an American citizen is passes overseas, whether that individual, however that individual succumbs, is to provide appropriate consular support. We'll be providing any necessary consular support in this case. But what we are calling for is an investigation, a comprehensive, a thorough investigation that ends with accountability. Thank you.
Yes. On Hong Kong, do you have anything on the arrest of the Catholic Cardinal Joseph Zen? And separately, if I may...
If you're just joining us on Al Jazeera, we've been listening there to the U.S. State Department spokesperson, Ned Price. who has been reacting to the killing of our colleague, Shireen Abu Akleh. He said this is a tragic loss and an affront to media freedom around the world. He said the U.S. calls for an immediate and thorough investigation, and we will continue to promote freedom of speech and the press. He said those responsible for the killing of Shireen should face the full extent of the law. Let's bring in Shihab Ratansi, who's at the State Department for us. Quite a heated press briefing there, Shihab.
And it's because of the precedent that we are also aware of, that in the main, Israeli investigations into their own conduct, into alleged war crimes, go nowhere. There was a pretty substantive report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz just last year, the end of last year, which traced investigations. It's true, Ned Price says, as he kept on repeating, Israelis have the wherewithal and capability to investigate. But do they do this? And then Ned Price pointed to one example, a very rare example, when a Palestinian man with special needs was shot at a checkpoint last year. And after a great deal of pressure, yes, charges were finally brought against a member of the security forces a year later. But that is so rare. That's why it was so notable. We know that in the main, what happens is the Israelis are always very quick to open an investigation, but then they tend to languish for months and months and months. And then when the cameras are off and no one's really paying attention, they're quietly closed in some bureaucratic corner of the Israeli system. Clearly, we're not going to let that happen, but clearly this led to that sort of skepticism from the journalistic core here at the State Department, that how can you possibly hold on to this idea of an investigation which will be substantive and lead to accountability from the Israelis themselves? And then we heard the AP correspondent there talking about the bombing of the Al Jazeera and AP offices in Gaza almost to the day this time last year. And so Ned Price said, oh, they were always very concerned about that. They expressed, they were troubled by what happened. They asked the Israelis for accountability and investigation. So when the AP reporter in the briefing there said, well, so did you get those answers? Were you satisfied with the answers? All Ned Price could say was, well, those concerns still exist. And that adds to that sense of incredulity that after all of the experience we've had over the years, that the US, when one of its own citizens, by the way, is shot dead by an Israeli sniper, are quite prepared for the Israelis to mount the investigation themselves. And again, the US is not a bystander in this. It's an American citizen who has been killed, our colleague Shireen, and also clearly, the U.S. gives $4 billion a year to Israel, $3.8 billion a year, which underwrites the occupation forces who killed Shireen.
Shihab, thank you for the moment. Shihab Ratansi, live for us there at the State Department in Washington. Now, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians has demanded an investigation into the systematic targeting of journalists by Israel. The independent organization, which works to protect the rights of Palestinians through the law, said Shireen dedicated her life to one of the most important principles in a democracy, freedom of speech. Journalists like Shireen are crucial in holding governments that violate international law to account. Israel's belligerent and excessive use of force has led to irreversible damage and the killing of innocent journalists. This can no longer be allowed to continue. Well, joining us now is Dawood Kutab, who's a journalist and former deputy chair of the International Press Institute. He's joining us from Amman in Jordan. Thank you very much for being with us. I believe you were able to hear some of the comments made by the U.S. State Department spokesperson there when he was pressed by journalists about what the U.S. would do. What did you make of what he had to say?
Well, as always, the words were good. The problem is the action. The whether the words that was said have teeth behind them. You know, we still are in a situation where the U.S. is giving a lot of money to Israel that is totally unaccountable for. There is no conditionality to it. There is no way that this would be controlled if Israel doesn't carry out whatever it promises. And the AP, the destruction of the AP building was just one other example. But there's been so many examples and so many areas in which Israel promised to do an investigation. They haven't done it. But I want to take you even further, because I think what most people don't understand is that Israel does not recognize the existence of Palestinian professional journalists. there are journalists who work for international agencies like the AP or like Al Jazeera, but that's they're only given accreditation because they work for AP and Al Jazeera. Nobody working for a Palestinian media is even recognized. We don't have, Israel doesn't even issue press cards or accreditation to Palestinian journalists. Israelis don't even recognize them. They deal with them like they deal with all other Palestinians as being enemy combatants of some kind. And so we have a real problem in that Israel gives lip service. Obviously, when the journalist works for Al Jazeera and happens to be an American, you know, all of a sudden, you know, even the Israeli narrative was changing. At one time, they say, oh, it's a Palestinian who killed her. And then all of a sudden, they changed their narrative because they realized that this was just not another journalist.
But this double standard is not coming just from Israel, unfortunately, is it? I mean, it's coming from everywhere around the world. When you look at the reaction from the international community, yes, our colleague was American and Palestinian. She was working for a major network. But there are lots of other Palestinian journalists who are targeted on a regular basis. And the reaction, unfortunately, is not the same.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And the problem is that unlike most other countries, you know, Russians kill American journalists. Okay, the Russians are the, you know, they're not the friends of the U.S. But Israel is a friend and is being supported financially. The veto power is used to support and defend Israel. The Article 7 of the punishment in the U.N. is not allowed to be used against Israel. So we're not dealing with Iran or with a country that is opposed to the U.S. We're dealing with a strong ally of the U.S. that continues to lie, continues to claim that they are going to investigate. They don't need to investigate. They gave the orders. You know, a sniper who hits the person right below the helmet and above the flank has to be a really good sniper. And snipers don't shoot somebody unless they get orders. Right. So somebody ordered this sniper to kill this woman, this Palestinian woman, who, you know, turns out to be an American. But that's not the case. The case is they didn't want anybody to film because they were coming in early in the morning. They wanted to do whatever they wanted to do in Jenin. And they didn't want anybody to record that, to document it. And that's why she was killed.
Do you think, Mr. Khutab, anything more can be done to make things easier and safer for journalists who are working in these kinds of areas in Palestine, in occupied Israeli territories?
On the larger sense, we need to end the occupation. Mm-hmm. But on the specific question that you asked, we need the state of Israel to be bound by international law in recognizing Palestinian journalists, not Palestinian journalists working for international press, the hundreds of Palestinian journalists who work for Palestinian media. You know, I mean, Shireen had the courage and the support to actually be there. Most other journalists couldn't even be closer. They would have been immediately taken out. So we need to have recognition of Palestinian journalists. The journalism profession has to be recognized, and there has to be really serious negotiations with Israel on how to deal with the journalists, how to make sure that they're protected, and how there has to be some kind of a memorandum of understanding between the occupiers and the Palestinian Journalist Union to organize how they can work in a safe environment. We don't have any of that. The Israeli Foreign Press Association every now and then talks to the Israelis, but basically the Israelis carry out in the farthest place out from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, in Jenin. That's where all the crimes happen, in Jenin and Gaza, in faraway places, because they know there isn't anybody watching. This time they got caught red-handed, and they got caught killing a well-known household name. You know, I mean, I don't know how much you know this, but everybody in the Arab world grows up every day, every night they watch Shireen. She's like a household name. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves her. She's very quiet. She's very to the point. She doesn't do gossip. She doesn't get emotional. She gives you the information. She was a perfect journalist. I mean, really, she was a really professional journalist.
A huge loss.
And we will miss her.
A huge loss for all of us. She was indeed known as the voice of Palestine. Thank you so very much, Mr. Khutab, for joining us. Daoud Khutab joining us there from Amman in Jordan. Well, let's discuss now the role of social media in all this and disinformation, misinformation, with Mark Owen, who's an assistant professor of Middle East Studies at Hamad bin Khalifa University, where his recent work has focused on the way social media has been used to spread disinformation. Thank you so much for being with us, Mark. Israeli forces issued a video earlier today which they said showed an armed Palestinian firing when our colleague was killed. We know that this is not true, of course. Talk us through the Israeli narrative on this and what you've seen unfold on social media today.
Okay, well, I think what's happening is a classic attempt at propaganda. The Israeli state is very used to managing these crisis situations in which they kill Palestinians, citizens, or journalists. So what they've done is they've already had a narrative, and that narrative is that there was an ambiguity about the killing of Shireen. In this case, there was a possibility that it could have been Palestinians. We know this is very implausible. However, this narrative was put out very early. The video in question was published by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which has a track record in using social media to disseminate falsehood. If you remember recently when Amnesty International released a report accusing the Israeli state of apartheid, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs took out an ad on Google accusing Amnesty of anti-Semitism. So we know that they have these strategies in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. With regards to Shireen Abu Akhla, they obviously want to use this time, because this time is crucial, and I can't emphasize this enough. This is the moment where there's going to be the most outpouring of outrage and grief about the killing of Shireen. So if they can cast doubt, if they can muddy waters around the death of Shireen by possibly getting newspapers in the international sphere to suggest that she was killed by a Palestinian, they have been successful. And in reality, this is what happened. The Guardian newspaper in the UK and the BBC have already been very clear about putting Israeli version of events very high up in their reporting of it. And so this is a huge, huge problem, and it's a deliberate strategy, I would say, from the Israeli PR team to try and muddy the waters.
I was going to ask you, in fact, whether the strategy was working. We've seen, as you've said, international news organizations like The Guardian reposting some of these videos and the narratives, anyway. Are people buying this, and how do we fight it?
I think a lot of people aren't buying it, but I think what is crucial is that in any case, I think you asked your previous guest about how we change these things, we need to change public opinion. Mm. And for the most part, if you have internationally acclaimed and reputable newspapers putting below the headline the Israeli version of offense, which is very implausible, then I think there's a case to be made that people will be influenced by this and that they will think there's credibility to the Israeli side of the story. So I think there's a massive question here for integrity of reporting. How much credibility does an entity such as the Israeli state have to lose through its repeated violations of international law, through it being an apartheid state, before journalists realize that they can't just report the narrative published by the Israeli government? This is a huge issue, and there really needs to be a lot of soul searching in the journalistic industry about how they narrate the events happening under the occupation.
Soul searching in the journalistic industry, but what about the role of social media entities like Twitter?
Twitter is a cesspit. We already know from what happened last year in the Gaza bombing that social media companies tend to have a strong relationship with the Israeli state when it comes to Palestine. They tend to be more censorial about pro-Palestinian content, and they tend to use certain rules and regulations against Palestinians. For example, they might censor Palestinian content based on the fact it's gory. Well, this is because Israel are launching bomb attacks against Palestinians. Of course, it's going to be gory. If you want to see the reality of war, this favors the person launching the war in the case of Israel and Palestine. So social media companies need to do more in tackling disinformation when it emanates from the Israeli state. But as I mentioned earlier, we've already seen, for example, Google taking ads out or allowing the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel to take ads criticizing a human rights organization of anti-Semitism, which actually violates Google's policy. So
three words: condemnation, disrespect, disproportionate. At a news conference at St. Joseph Church Hospital, its leaders and clergy condemned the Israeli police for Friday's attack against Shireen Abu Akhla's coffin and the pallbearers, accusing them of disrespecting the hospital grounds, and finally said it was a disproportionate use of force.
The police stormed into a Christian health institute, disrespecting the church, disrespecting the health institute, disrespecting the memory of the deceased, and forcing the pallbearers almost to drop the coffin.
The church authorities released previously unseen security camera footage of Israeli police entering the hospital, which said there was absolutely no reason for this to have happened. Its general director says all concerned parties are now discussing what to do next.
Most probably court case. We are now discussing with church leader, Catholic church leader, and the owners of the hospital, the Sisters of St. Joseph, and the administration of the hospital about the next legal action to be taken.
Initially, the Israeli police said they were acting on the instructions of the family, something Shireen's brother, who is the family's representative, denies.
Absolutely not. The Israeli police called me to the police station to know the exact route we are taking, asked me not to have any Palestinian flags risen during the funeral, no slogans, no chanting during the funeral, and I stress that this is not only my funeral, not for Abu Akleh only, not for the Abu Akleh family only, but it's a national funeral. Everybody will participate. I can't tell you the exact number of people who will participate. I told them that the funeral will leave from St. Joseph Hospital to the Greek Malachite Church in Jaffa Gate and then to the final cemetery in Mount Zion.
The church authorities and the hospital are now weighing up their legal options. The Israeli police say they will investigate the incident that took place here on Friday, and the Israeli army say they are investigating the death of Shireen Abu Akleh. But given previous investigations, no one here or indeed members of the family hold out any hope that that will be an independent investigation. And indeed, Shireen Abu Akleh's family are saying that they would like an independent international investigation. But calls for that so far have not been heeded. Imran Khan, Al Jazeera, Occupied East Jerusalem.
Sorsan Zahar is a human rights lawyer and a board member at B'Tselem. It's a non-profit group with a focus on documenting human rights violations in Palestine. She explains how the Israeli government could be held accountable for storming the hospital.
The fact that we are talking about a hospital that is being operated by St. Joseph, by French operation, in the occupied territory does impose international obligation on the state of Israel. And in any case, even if we're talking only about a regular hospital in Israel, this conduct, this invasion is also illegal because entering in this way to a hospital, violating and attacking patients, attacking innocents that are that were present in the hospital. We all saw the shock of people, of doctors during the filming of and the documentation of this video. All of it is also illegal based on international law, even if it doesn't have diplomatic immunity.
And these are live pictures from Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. The Church of Nativity is holding a commemoration service for Al Jazeera's Shireen Abu Akleh. An hour later, the event will move outside to Bethlehem Square, and then we believe a few hours after that, a candle vigil will be held also in Bethlehem Square at 1700 GMT. It comes after Shireen's death on Wednesday, the 11th of May.
What are Americans doing at a scene like this from occupied East Jerusalem? In exclusive footage obtained by AJ Plus, you're watching a group of Americans build a fence outside one Palestinian family's home in Sheikh Jarrah.
Smile, smile.
And they were hired to do it by the founder of a U.S. registered charity.
Where are you from? Why are you doing this?
Understand what you are doing.
In the last decade, U.S. charities have funneled millions of dollars to settler groups, and these donations are tax deductible, meaning Americans are effectively subsidizing settlement activity, which is considered illegal under international law. Now, Palestinians are appealing to people in the U.S. to stop funding their oppression. And that call is being answered.
And just as they are not welcome in Palestine, they are not welcome in New York City!
As the families impacted wage a relentless battle to stay in their homes. For now, their fate remains undecided. In this report for AJ Plus, we explore the links between the settler movement in Israel, charitable giving in the U.S.
Just one question, Rabbi, please.
And the people who are participating in it.
What's a guy from Virginia doing building a fence around a Palestinian family's home?
This is Sheikh Jarrah, a Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem that was occupied by Israel in 1967. It's against international law to push Palestinians out of this area, but that hasn't stopped settlers from using Israeli courts to do just that.
You are stealing my house!
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No, no one!
The viral video of the El-Kurd family confronting Jacob the Settler is a crude example of how an American from Long Island could be directly involved in efforts to remove people from their homes.
This is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
And he's not alone. AJ Plus is following attempts to evict another family from Sheikh Jarrah, and what we found is a network of Israeli settlers tied to charity donations from abroad and Americans themselves who are connected to efforts to displace the Salem family. The Salems have lived in this home for over 70 years. 11 family members live under this roof, and the head of the household, Fatima, was born here.
Hey, daddy. قال إني أبوي أسمعهم البيت معهم كبرت هون جوزت هون طردت هون أنا وجبت ولادي إبراهيم وخليل وأيوب بنات.
Of the 200 families living in this neighborhood, at least 93 are facing eviction, according to the Israeli NGO Peace Now.
مش راح نطلع من مرة هنا قاعدين هون هم يجوا يطلعونا بدخل لهم من فوق الباب.
In early December, City Council member and right-wing settler Yonatan Yosef and the Deputy Mayor of Jerusalem, Aria King, delivered an eviction notice to Fatima. Aria King is a central figure in the settler movement. He founded the Israel Land Fund, a group that advertises and facilitates property sales exclusively for Jewish residents.
The Israel Land Fund is dedicated to putting the land of Israel back into Jewish hands.
On its website, which has since been updated, you could find investing opportunities for, quote, ideology properties. But instead of Sheikh Jarrah, it's called the Hebrew Nakalat Shimon. In one listing, it said plots were being squatted on by Arabs who have built on them illegally or are renting. In an interview with AJ Plus, King was unapologetic about the Israel Land Fund's mission.
היחידים שיש להם בנפיט זה העם היהודי. המטרה של הקרן אדמות ישראל כשהוקמה היא שיהיה כמה שיותר אדמה בארץ ישראל בבעלות כמה שיותר יהודים, וזו המטרה.
From 2011 to 2017, almost all of its donations were from the Central Fund of Israel, a New York-based non-profit. And the Israel Land Fund's director is this man, Ben Packer, a nationalist rabbi from Virginia who also runs a youth hostel in Jerusalem that's been called out for its ties to extremism. Just days after the Salem family received its eviction notice, Ben Packer and a group of young Americans were caught on camera fencing off the land adjacent to the Salem house.
What are you doing? Where are you from? I'm Israeli. Where are you from? Why are you doing this?
I work for the contractor.
You work with the contractor, huh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Understand what you are doing.
With the tacit support of Israeli police, the Americans and Israeli settlers installed wiring and a fence around the land just outside the family's home.
Can you get pictures?
Hold on. 1 second.
Oh, you're American?
And this is how Israeli settlements begin. Nearly every government in the world thinks projects like this are illegal. Israel does not. Fatima's sons pleaded with the police to recognize that this has been their family's home for generations. The Salems were among the 700,000 Palestinian refugees who were violently forced from their homes during Israel's creation in 1948. As the Salem family resisted their efforts, the American crew, led by Packer, refused to stop building the fence. The group's efforts were punctuated by moments where they played up to the camera and listened to music on their phones. Settler work relies on a wide range of government and civic support, and Americans coming to Israel to participate in projects like this is just another part of that process.
On camera.
A bystander in the crowd even tried to call them out.
Yeah, you come into somebody's neighborhood, you decide you're going to put up a fence on a piece of property that hasn't ever been fenced because you think it's yours. This land isn't yours. Everybody knows this land isn't yours. How long have you guys been here?
How long have you been here?
Well, 12 years.
The cars. Look at this car.
So you fenced in this territory because of the car.
It's a parking lot that belongs to us.
Oh, it belongs to you.
Soon, a key player in the settler movement shows up to the site. It's Aria King. We were able to identify several of the Americans who showed up to the Salem family house. AJ Plus reached out to them for comment. None of them responded. We also sent several requests to speak to Ben Packer, but didn't hear back. So when we learned that he was in the U.S. to raise money, we went looking for him. We've just landed in Charlotte, North Carolina, because we've learned that Rabbi Ben Packer is here giving a series of lectures. So we're going to see if we can find him and ask him some questions. After waiting around for a few hours in a parking lot, we spotted him. Hi, Rabbi Packer.
Hi,
I'm Angie from AJ Plus.
Hello.
Hi, I've been trying to reach out to you for an interview, see if we could talk.
Yeah.
Do you have a couple minutes now before you go in? Just answer a few questions.
No.
Just one question, Rabbi, please.
No.
Rabbi, can I tell you that we've seen footage of you at the Salem family property, and we just want to know, what's a guy from Virginia doing building a fence around a Palestinian family's home? What was the purpose of the fence? Rabbi, do you want to tell us who you were working on behalf of when you put the fence up? The outspoken rabbi, who in Palestine screamed in the faces of the people trying to stop him, was to us almost completely silent. It's really unfortunate that we couldn't get any answers tonight. Back in Sheikh Jarrah, the work to evict this family continues. And it's happening because people like Chaim Silberstein can use Israel's legal system to forcibly remove Palestinians. Chaim heads a New Jersey registered charity called Keep Jerusalem. It's played a pivotal role in influencing policy and public opinion on issues of land ownership. At the site, he ignored the videographer who was filming him. Here's how this eviction is happening. Documents revealed here show that Chaim paid roughly $100,000 to buy the land from the descendants of the Jewish family who lived here before the Arab-Israeli War in 1948. And this is key because Jewish residents have a legal process to reclaim land. Palestinians do not. He later transferred the property rights to another man who transferred it again to Yonatan Yosef. Remember, Yonatan is a member of the Israel Land Fund who showed up with Aria King to hand deliver Fatima's eviction. Documents reviewed by AJ Plus confirm that Chaim and Aria's operations have relied heavily on U.S. charities and American tax-deductible donations. Chaim and Aria deny using charity money to acquire land. Yonatan did not respond to our request for comment. We reached out for interviews. Chaim agreed.
It's no secret that we see Jerusalem as the eternal capital of the Jewish people.
Where did the money come from to make the purchase for Lot 47?
That's not for disclosure publicly. I don't think it would be right to share information about where funds came from to buy properties.
Did you use funds from any of your charities to pay for that plot of land?
I never use any funds from any of our charities to to participate in land reclamation. My charities, the charities that I run, are only educational. We only do advocacy work.
I'm just trying to clear this up because it was my understanding that you're the person who bought the property. You're listed as the trustee.
I was originally a trustee simply because the investor at the time was not in the country to sign the contract, and therefore I signed for him as a trustee, but I did not buy it. I did not use my own funds. I simply at the time signed the contract temporarily until the purchaser could take over the property legally. The goal here is to let original owners or people that are sympathetic to the cause to reclaim these properties back to the Jewish people.
But the original owners aren't moving back in, and as a result of his actions, Palestinian families are forced from their homes. Chaim's charity has received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the U.S. and Canada, and its mission is to secure a Jewish majority in Jerusalem. In presentations available online, Keep Jerusalem says it's petitioned to demolish homes. Every settler organization has its own strategies, but what unites them is the belief that Jewish people have a biblically ordained right to the land at the expense of Palestinians and in clear violation of international law. And that's why activists from the Defund Racism Coalition are calling on New York State to strip the charity status of pro-settler nonprofits.
If you stand against the displacement of the Palestinian people, you have to stand for these organizations to have their 501c3 tax charitable status revoked.
People who donate to these charities can write it off their taxes, so American taxpayers end up subsidizing it for them.
The fact that we pay for this, the fact that our taxes fund it, and the fact that these Zionist organizations run rampant all over our city, opening up headquarters, operating freely, absolutely makes it our duty and responsibility to call them out and to say that we don't want our money kicking Palestinian people out of their homes, and we don't want our money building and expanding Israeli settlement.
At least 10 of these charities have addresses in Midtown Manhattan, and protesters marched along a route to point some of them out.
It's that building right over there. So when we approach it, I want us to be as loud as possible because I want them to hear us up there.
Back in Sheikh Jarrah, new levels of provocation continue outside the Salem home. This time, a far-right member of the Knesset set up a makeshift office outside the family's home, declaring, quote, "We are the landlords." 70-year-old Fatima was injured and later hospitalized during confrontations that followed. Still, her Palestinian neighbors remained defiant and prayed in front of the politician's tent. Later that night, at least a dozen people were injured in violence. It's now just a few weeks away from the Salem family's eviction date, but the community continues to resist. And Fatima is firm on their future. Her family will do whatever it takes to stay in their home.
Thank you. such a narrow cobblestone streets that became crowded with fear. Israeli police say more than 70,000 people turned out for Sunday's Jerusalem Day flag march. It drew protests from Palestinians, tensions boiled, clashes erupted, and scores of Palestinians were injured. CNN's Atika Schubert brings us the story from Jerusalem.
Jerusalem Day is a day that shows just how bitterly contested the city is. For Israelis, particularly Jewish nationalists, it has become a day to mark Israel's capturing of all the city, including East Jerusalem, in the 1967 war, and the holiest site in Judaism, the Western Wall. Thousands upon thousands converge on Jerusalem's old city, marching through with Israeli flags. Some chant, "Death to Arabs." This is one extreme among the marchers. Others here say the day should be a celebration, not a provocation.
Most of the people want to live in peace, and you, as you can see, we live in peace. I didn't come to provoke someone. You understand I didn't come for it. I'm not making problem. I'm not shouting, die to the Arabs. You saw the guy that wanted the Arabs to be dead. I told him not, because I don't want them to be dead. I want them to be my neighbors. But, you know, I don't want them to kill me at the same time.
But for Palestinians, this is a day of provocation. When the Israeli flag march goes through one of the most disputed areas of East Jerusalem, and it's almost inevitable that tensions will boil over. Thousands of police are deployed, but scuffles still break out in the narrow cobblestone streets. Police fire pepper spray and swing batons. Palestinian residents say they feel angry, frustrated, and exhausted.
We cannot live, no peace at home, no peace in the shop, no peace in the street, no peace anywhere. Now a settler could come hit me, he will go and arrest me. Where is justice?
In a sea of flags, there is one that cannot be flown. The Palestinian flag. Israeli police quickly tackle the elderly man who dared to unfurl it. If the march of flags went ahead, Hamas warned, it would fire rockets from Gaza. Watch the skies, the militant group warned. What came instead was a small gesture of defiance instead of rockets, keeping Jerusalem's uneasy peace for another day. Atika Schubert for CNN in Jerusalem.
Well, for the aftermath, we're live in Jerusalem with CNN's Hadass Gold. And I note the headline in the Times of Israel today: through Jerusalem's Muslim quarter, a triumphalist march by Orthodox nationalist men. And it goes on to suggest that for some, this decades-old anniversary or celebration, Jerusalem Day, has morphed into something darker. Your perspective from there.
Yeah, Becky, I mean, we're getting updated numbers that some 70,000 people participated in that march. And you're right that what is many Israelis see as something to celebrate when Israel gained control of East Jerusalem, and Israelis see this as when Jerusalem became a united capital. For many Palestinians, they see it as a provocation because they want East Jerusalem to be the capital of a future Palestinian state. And they and much of the international community consider East Jerusalem to be occupied territory. But Becky, if you go to these marches, you do not see the kind of average secular Israeli. Who you mostly see are what many people consider right-wing Zionists or settlers, even, who come in from the West Bank or come in from other parts of Israel. You do not see either ultra-Orthodox people, nor do you see secular Israelis. And that's what a lot of Israeli commentators are talking about, that this march has morphed into this sort of magnet for the right-wing extremist groups. I want to read to you some of the reactions from Israeli politicians. The prime minister said that what happened yesterday, those events were from a minority that had come to set the area ablaze. Yair Lapid, the foreign minister, has sent out several tweets and statements. I'll read you one of them. He talked about how sorry, I don't have the tweet in front of me, but he also condemned the action and said things that these groups, some of these right-wing groups like Lehava and La Familia, he said that they do not deserve to carry the Israeli flag. Now, Lehava and La Familia are these two extremist right-wing organizations, and they're sometimes identified in these marches with their black flags. One of them, La Familia, actually uses the flag from the Jerusalem Beitar Football Club. There are now growing calls to outlaw these two groups. I want to play for you what the defense minister said just earlier today.
As defense minister, I also think the time has come to re-examine the designation of organizations like La Familia and Lehava as terror organizations. I know this issue is on the doorstep of the various security organizations, and I rely on them to carry out the examination in the cleanest and best way.
Now, labeling those organizations as terror organizations would outlaw them, which would mean it would be illegal to fly those flags and to be part of those organizations. Now, whether these calls for outlawing these organizations, for labeling them as terrorists, will actually come to action, that will be the big question next here. Becky.
Had us gold on the story. Thank you.
That was three reports on the latest developments in Israel's campaign against Palestine. We'll continue to follow that story and others here on Conscious Voices in the coming weeks here on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care.